Hit it.
Huh? You want me to start?
You bet.
Yeah, do about 15 minutes on this, and then I'll just pick it up and do 15, and we'll do 15 apiece on 5, 6, and 7. See if we can wrap those.
I just going to get some more bottled water. Do you guys want sodas or anything while we're at?
Diet soda.
What kind?
Good. Pepsi or Coke?
Diet Pepsi or Coke? And how
I'm
about
good.
You?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
My name's Bob Darrell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Well, now we're going to do sex right here in this room. Half of you woke up, the other half wanted to run. Bottom of page 68 starts the section on sex. It says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. What does that mean? I want pictures. They see its significance everywhere.
One, you said you'd be good.
I know. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet, cayenne pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. This is a controversy that's been going on and cycling through our society for centuries. If you were to track sexual morals in society over the last several centuries, you'd see it goes from one extreme to another. I mean, if any of you were little kids or even remember from watching Nick at Night, the sexual morals of the 50s. I mean, TV shows didn't even have bedrooms. I mean, or even the first ones with bedrooms, they had separate beds, right? It was like, and then what happened? Huh?
The first couple shown in bed together on television was the Flintstones.
Right, right.
That's right.
They had to be a cartoon. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And then what followed that dig? The 60s, where, my God, it was free love, or at least it was reasonably priced or something. You know, it was like there were orgies and love-ins, and I mean, even the most pathetic of us had a chance in those days. And then it's society is cycled like that. Through Elizabethan time, I mean, just it's cycled like that from one extreme to the other. And why would the pendulum go like that? Because neither extreme really works. People get hurt in both ends. The book goes on to say we're not to be the arbiter. We must not be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. This isn't about sex. We don't even have an opinion of where you are in the spectrum of sexuality. It doesn't matter. The inventory we're about to engage in is not about sex. It's about exactly what it said it was about in the beginning. We're looking for the manifestations of self which had defeated us. It's about selfishness. It's about inconsideration. It's about manipulation through arousing jealousy, suspicion, bitterness. It's about dishonesty. It's about all of that. We don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And that's good news to some of us. Most of us, I think. You know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years. I've heard a lot of fifth steps. And I'll tell you something that I think is amazing. And no matter where you were in the scope of sexuality, as far as frequency, etc., no matter how bizarre you were, whatever, everybody on the spectrum feels bad about themselves. The people who were so locked up sexually that they only had two people on their whole sexual inventory and they had to be drunk in both cases felt there was something wrong with them. And the person that had 400 names felt there was something wrong with them too. Whether you, no matter where you were, we all come in here with a feeling that we're not quite right. A feeling of inadequacy, a feeling of not enoughness. I live in a city with a billion-dollar plastic surgery industry that feeds off of people who tell themselves a lie. And the lie is, as is, God made you, you ain't enough. And the more you believe that lie and feed it, the stronger it gets. Right? I know a woman in California, good gal. She's had 27 plastic surgeries. Every one, and she got to the point. At one point, she looked like a model in a magazine. Then she went so far past that, she started looking a little odd, actually, almost cartoonish after a while. But it was never enough. It was never, ever. She could never look in the mirror and be comfortable with what she saw, no matter how gorgeous she looked. And the problem was not in reality. The problem is in here, right? So we don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We have everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that exists in society, that's existed for every nation on earth, from the beginning of time. We have heterosexuals, we have homosexuals, we have bisexuals. I have a friend who says he's a quatrosexual. I said, "What's that?" He says, "Oh, I'd have done anything with anyone at any time for a quarter." Right. Transsex. We have everything in alcohol. Everything that there is, we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. But we try to be the arbiter of your spirit. There's an old adage about recovery is that we must become right with ourselves. Whatever you find as you clear away everything that's not you is what you're left with, and you have to be right with that, whatever that may be. We all have sex problems. That's really true. I know some guys, I run into guys every once in a while, they're new, and they want to tell me about how oversexed they were. My friend Charlie says it best. He says, "You're not oversexed, you're undersecure." We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Well, here's what we do. And we're making a list again, just like we did, I believe. I'm a list guy. It says, reviewed our conduct over the years past. So I was instructed, and I tell my guys that I sponsor, you make a list of all interactions where there's sexual energy. Even if the sexual act isn't actually consummated, if it has aroused that deal in you, you want to see how self-centeredness manifests itself when those instincts are aroused. And in the 12x12, it talks about the three basic instincts, the three S's: the instinct for security, both emotional and material, the instinct for sex, and the instinct for a place in society. In other words, what we think other people think of us. We want to feel comfortable with our place in society. And in the sexual arena, it's the one area where all three of those instincts can be threatened severely, especially in a long-term relationship. If you're in a long-term relationship, a marriage, especially if it's a community property state, your material security is in danger. Your emotional security is in danger. Your position in society is in danger, because I don't know anybody that wants to go back to their family or home group or church or anywhere where they have the friends and have to tell their friends that I failed again at another one, right? I don't know anybody. And then your sex is threatened. So because of that, I think that there's more self-centered angst in the sexual arena than any other arena. That's why it makes some of us so crazy. If I get a phone call from a guy at 4 a.m. and he's thinking about drinking or sticking a pistol in his mouth or in somebody else's head, it's usually because of a sexual relationship that's gone sideways on him. it makes him insane. Because all three, because the greater the self-centered fear, the greater the insanity. Right? And it's the one area where you can have self-centered fear, because all of your instincts can be threatened. And so what do? It says we list those relationships. And I ask myself these questions. Where had I been selfish? Well, when you do that through your whole life in every relationship, man, it starts, every single time. Is that the truth was, even though I dressed it up and I could be so loving and attentive and all this other crap, the real truth was, it was all about me. I could act loving and other-centered and altruistic, but the real truth was, I want something. I want your love. I want your attention. I want to get laid. I want not to be alone. I want companionship. It's all about me. And I realized, I looked back through and I thought, oh my God, I'm such a me first person. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And the second question, dishonesty. I found that most problems in this arena come from dishonesty. And it's often a delusional dishonesty where we don't even get that we're being dishonest. It's that we try to write checks we can't cash. It's a psychotic wishful thinking. It's really not this way, but God, I want it to be this way so badly, I imagine it is, when it's not. Right? I think I run into guys all the time, and I think there's a little bit of this in everybody, every one of us. This hole inside of us, we misinterpret. What happens when you take the alcohol and drugs out of your life and you're 2 years sober and you haven't worked the steps and you got this big vacancy? It starts looking a little bit easily like a relationship-shaped hole. Right? Doesn't it? You start thinking, you know, what's missing? And you get all of a sudden you start looking around your home group, you know, looking around the gym, looking around work, right? Driven by self. It's really a God-shaped hole. You know how you know that? Because you can try to fill it with an endless series of people, and it never gets full. It's always the same thing, over and over and over again. I heard a guy years ago say something I thought was very true. He says, you have no hope of having a healthy relationship until you no longer need one. Right? If all you're bringing to the table is vacancy, then that's all you're bringing to the table. Relationships are for whole people. They're not. You can't make a whole person with two crippled children. You can't do. I mean, it's a nice dance, but it just doesn't work. I'll tell you a couple kind of types of dishonesty. I heard this many, many years ago. This story about this guy and this gal that both got sober around the same time. And their sponsors had both told them not to be sexually involved with anybody for a year. Some of you are going to find this hard to believe. They actually did that. But by the time the year came, they were kind of over ready. You know what I mean? And for the last 2 months, they'd been making cow eyes at each other across the home group. You know how you've seen that in AA. You see it in AA. Yeah. You know, and one day at the coffee bar, at the break in the speaker meeting, they bump into each other and go into heat. You can get a suntan standing around somebody like that, you know. Oh, man. And, you know, they go into that, they start dating, and they're in that infatuation stage of a relationship. It's like you took some amazing drug, man. It's like, do you ever know, when you're in that infatuation, it's like, the sky's bluer than it's ever been. Oh, she's so brilliant and funny and life's good. God really loves me now. You know, it's you're nuts. You should be locked up, man. You're crazy. It's a wonderful drug, man. I'm telling you. And they're in that infatuation stage. And one Saturday afternoon, he says to her, he says, "Sweetheart, what are you doing tomorrow afternoon?" She goes, "Oh, I don't know. What are you doing?" He says, "Well, the big football game's on. I don't know if you like football, but I'd, if you come over and watch the football game with me, I thought, if you like that, would you like to do that? She says, oh, I'd love that. Yes. Well, she hates football, the truth is. But at that stage in their relationship, she'd have gone to a rock fight with this guy. I mean, and been glad to get hit with stones, you know. And, oh, he loves me, you know. Well, it's, let me say, I'm not just, guys are worse. So if you think I'm targeting women, guys are worse. I'll get to that in a minute. So they go, eventually end up living together and are engaged to be married, and everything's wonderful. And a year later, Sunday morning, she says to him, she says, I want you to come to the mall this afternoon with me. We got to get pick some stuff out for the place. And he says, oh, sweetheart, not this afternoon. The big game's on. I thought we'd sit in the sofa, I'll make some popcorn, watch the game. And she flips out. She starts yelling at him, I hate that football. And he's looking at her like, who are you? What did aliens steal my girlfriend? I mean, who are you? And she never set out to lie to him. We don't lie because we're liars. We lie because we're afraid. We write checks we can't cash, hoping that maybe it will be true. Guys are worse. There's a time in a relationship between a man and a woman where they've been dating a while and they haven't slept with each other. And then that night comes and, you know, you can feel it in the air. You know it's going to happen. And there's a point about a minute out from the consummation of the sexual act where a woman can stop a guy and say, sweetheart, before we go any further, do you really, really love me and want to spend the rest of your life with me? And the guy will go, he's like the Alpo dog on the commercial that they haven't fed in a week. You know, like... And you can put him on a lie detector. And when he's saying yes, it'll say he's telling the truth. Square business. I have a friend who was in that spot, and a day or two later, she pulls up to his place pulling a U-Haul. She got rid of her apartment, packed her stuff up, and he's looking at the U-Haul going, wow, what's that? And he said, but you said you wanted to spend the rest of your life with me. And he's going, oh, yeah, I did, didn't I? Oh, man. I have a friend who's he doesn't go to AA anymore. But he's very involved in another 12-step program, and he tells his sponsees, "Look, you can sleep with them, just don't talk to them because you're going to probably lie." And where does this come from? It comes from this self-centered fear, this fear of not being loved, the fear just like fears and resentments, these are judgments that I must try to dismantle that are part of this ego that has told me things that are part of my old ideas. It told me things like, as you are, you're not enough. Nobody's going to love you as is. So what happens is you have to write checks you can't cash. You have to be something more than what you are. I know a gal and a guy that fell in love and they were engaged to be married. Before they got married, they had the money talk, a very, very important talk, where you talk about finances and debt and everything. And the guy asked her, he said, do you ever had a bankruptcy? And she says, oh, no. She was working on her second one. Matter of fact, if she didn't marry this guy, she was going to be in one pretty quick because her credit cards were maxed out. He said, do you have any credit card debt? She says, oh, no, I don't believe in carrying a balance on my credit cards, because she had heard him talk to his sponsees and tell him about how you don't carry a balance. That's a sucker bet. You always pay things off right away. You can't, if you're in AA, you can't go bankrupt because you're using a technicality to beat somebody out of something. You're spiritually bound to make that right. And so why did she say all that? Because she believed an old lie, and the lie was, if he really knew these things about me that aren't right, he probably won't love me. The problem is that they got married, and of course all of that stuff comes to the surface. Of course it does. You financially mix yourself with someone. Eventually, it comes to the surface, and now it's eroding the foundation of the relationship. And when the relationship fell apart, her ego said, "See, you were right." When he found out about your imperfections, he didn't love you, and that's not the deal. That was her mistake. She mistooking the truth from it. The truth was, if she would have, I know this guy. If she would have said to him, "Sweetheart, I've screwed my life up financially. My credit cards are maxed out." I believe he would have said, "Okay, I love you. We're going to work with this. I think I'll handle the money, but we're going to work with this." And she could have. She was this close to finding out the sweetest thing she could have ever found out is someone would actually love her as is. But her ego told her the lie, and she believed it. And when the marriage fell apart, see, the ego said, "See," when he did find out about you, "See?" And that wasn't the truth. And how much we reinforce that stuff in ourselves over and over again. You want to go for a few little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you for a minute.
Okay.
Trust is a yes or no question. I'm working with a guy right now who has done some financial things that he hid from his wife, and then he finally had to admit it. And now she thinks he's having an affair. He's not. He's not. But she has no reason to trust him. I don't trust you in all of these categories, but not in that one. Trust is a yes or no question. Before I go on, I want to put in a plug for, I don't know what happens at this particular retreat, but you don't want to miss my wife's talk tonight. If you're not in Al-Anon, don't miss it anyway. She's got some fabulous stuff. And the other thing is I want to remind you that we're going to start tomorrow morning at 8:30, not 9 o'clock, as the schedule says. Because if I don't write this stuff down, it don't happen for me either. A couple of pieces here, strangely enough. I went to my mentor, and I said, this thing about we don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I said, help me with that. What do you do with a new guy? He said, well, if he's married, pretty clear. If he's single, this is what I say to him. I'm going to ask you to leave the women alone until I get you all the way through the 12 steps. There are two reasons for that. The first one is that I want your time and energy on this step work. The second one is, as sick as you are, healthy women generally run screaming from guys like you. Now, you may currently have one fooled. That does happen. But generally, they run screaming from guys like you. If I can get you through these 12 steps, one of the things that happens is we get you healthy, put you in a position to have a chance to attract a healthy female. It's one of the side effects. But our old friend Keith used to say that two newcomers dating is like having two ticks and no dog. They just suck at each other dry, and I think that's just about right. And
two ticks and no dog.
Yeah, and I really took that from my teacher, and I said, you know, that makes perfect sense to me. So I present that to the new guy. And I said, now you can choose to, this is some more from him, you can choose to ignore my recommendation in this category, and I won't drop you as a sponsee for doing that, but don't bring me the problems you create for yourself in this category. I've already told you what I think you need to do. See, and that solves my problem, right? And then the truth is, I'll handle the first one with him and point at all of these facts. And then after that, you know, I really don't want to hear it. I've already told you. You want to keep, you know, you know, the first rule of holes is when you're in one, quit digging. If he can't quit digging, I can't help him in that category anyway. What I like to do is, like he said, a column inventory. It just says we got this down on paper and looked at it, doesn't tell us how. I like to use whom had we hurt for a first column. Works pretty good. Selfish, honest, inconsiderate. Last column is where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? And I'm going to share mine with you for a single reason, as there may be people in here who will die if I don't. Part of what happened for me in this process is I became comfortable enough with my past in God's hands for him to use it. And part of what keeps it clean and light and airy instead of having the stench it used to have is my willingness for him to use it. So I'm going to share this with you. My last column only has three entries, and it says I should have told her the truth, or it says I should have left her alone, or it says I should have told him no. That's what it says. I had my last homosexual experience when I was 19 years old. I'm a raging heterosexual. I never liked it. My father had beaten me down so hard psychologically that I was unable to tell anybody no for any reason for anything. I was 19 when I was able to do that. I'm not attacking homosexuals. I sponsor a homosexual guy who the worst thing he ever did was try to have a heterosexual relationship. Okay? I understand that. But that's just how it was for me. I have a therapist friend who says somewhere around 50 or 60% of adult heterosexual males have had a homosexual experience of some kind. Bob and I have compared notes. We believe between us we've heard around 300 fist steps. We think the number's in the 90s. We spoke with a lady friend of ours who's sober over 40 years, and we asked her about women and the fist steps she'd heard. She said it's around 80%. So if that's the one that's eating one of you guys, come talk to me. I'd be more than happy to talk to you. That's usually the one they can't dump in step five. It's the one that's killing you. Do you observe me that I don't change any when I shared all that stuff with you? Can you see that there's no weight on that for me anymore? I believe that's available to everybody. Not just that particular instance, but whatever it is. Whatever it is. That's what this thing is about, is a new freedom. The old freedom was four shots of tequila. This is a new freedom. It has to be new. And I have to do other things to get it. And then it tells us in this next paragraph, why are we doing all this? It says to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. Was it selfish or not? And it says, we ask God, oh my goodness, we're going to talk to God about sex. Well, I have news. He's the one that invented it. Do you ever think about that? Nice job. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I really do. And so I'm going to talk to him about my ideal. And so I asked this guy I'm sponsoring, talk to God about your ideal. And I want you to write it down. The ideal, by the way, does not have to do with her dress size or the color of her hair. It has to do with your behavior, given your current set of circumstances today. For example, if you're currently single, we don't need to know what it would be if you were married but temporarily separated but not legally separated, but you thought she had a boyfriend but you weren't sure. We don't need that one, Stanley. You're working too hard. Let's get the today word into this thing. What do you think God wants you to do / not do in this category today? Mine is simple. I'm married to a spectacular woman. Miss Linda's supposed to get all of my sex energy. It's that simple. I'm 65 years old. I have some good news for you guys who are afraid you're going to live to be 65. I have some really good news for you. And then I tell the guy, I tell him, if you want to read me your sexual ideal, I'd be happy to hear it, but I don't require that. But I'll tell you, when you're writing it, if you go past about three lines, you didn't understand the concept. But let's get it on paper so you really know what it is. Not to be used lightly or despised or loathed. And then we're supposed to be willing to grow toward this thing. It's okay if I make a couple of mistakes. Actually, not anymore. It's not. But when somebody is new, I think it's okay if they make a couple of mistakes. That's what it says here. And we're asking God in meditation what we should do about each specific matter. And here's the willingness again to make amends if we've done harm. Sounds again like step eight. On page 70, it says, suppose we fall short. That paragraph sums up, and what it says very simply is, if you're doing things in the sexual arena that are hurting God's kids, you're going to drink. That wasn't maybe. And if I see someone I sponsor doing that, I tell them, because that's what it says here. And if they continue to do things that are harming people, I can't work with them. If somebody's doing something that's going to take them back to the bar and they won't stop it, I can't help them. They've proven to me I can't help them. That's what I do. I'm not recommending that to anybody. And then it says, to sum up about sex, we're praying again for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situations, for sanity, strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. Some friends of mine and I, as we do our two pages, we read two pages a day in the big book, we started tracking all the places in the book that reference helping others. We found over 60 so far, and that's not in the stories. That's the early Roman numerals through 164. And if you want that list, if you'll email me, I'll be happy to send them to you. We throw ourselves the harder on helping others, think of their needs, work for them. Takes us out of ourselves and quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. And then this next paragraph is what pilots call a checklist. It says, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. If you've written all of the things that we discovered today that are written in step four, and you've never done an actual four-step before, probably you've written down a lot. Then it says, we've listed and analyzed our resentments. We covered that, didn't we? We had a list. We did a lot of analysis. We covered that. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. Yeah, we killed you 7 times on that one page. We've commenced to see the terrible destructiveness. We covered that, didn't we? We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. We look on them as sick people. We covered that, didn't we? We've listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. We found that at the end of the resentment inventory. We also just found it toward the end of the sexual misconduct inventory. I would propose to you, if you've done something that somebody else alleged to you as a four-step, and you can't answer yes to all everything in that paragraph, you might try the real four-step. I think you will find it to be a life-changing experience. It was for me and for the men I've had the privilege of working with where we began to dig the poison out of the soul. There's a tremendous cleansing that comes from laying down those resentments, beginning to outgrow the fears, to step out into the sunlight of the Spirit on this sex thing and do it the way it's supposed to be done. It's a whole different ball game, whole different thing between making love and getting laid are different. And I didn't know that. And it says in this book, you read it again and again, faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, that would be the third step decision we talked about, and an inventory of your gross or handicaps, that's what we covered today. You've made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. I studied biology. I know what happens after swallow and digest, right? That stuff's out of here. And step four is about out of here. It's about out of here. Powerful, powerful stuff. We're going to move on. I'm going to start on five.
When do we end? I forget.
Quarter after.
Okay.
We got 30 minutes. Yep. You want to start on five?
No, go ahead.
Okay. We make this up at the breaks.
Yep. I say one thing?
We really do. Yeah.
For a friend of mine says that, look, I don't have an opinion on this. He says that looking for a mate in Alcoholics Anonymous is like shopping in the dented cans section of the grocery store. You might get a good set of niblets, but you might get botulism, too. We don't know.
Yeah, at my home group, we say dating before you've actually done the 12 steps is like pouring Miracle-Gro on your character defects. Yeah, it'll just make you absolutely crazy. Moving on to page 70, at the end of the first paragraph, it says this brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery. So there's a I'm sorry, 72. That's a reference to the fact that this is our program of recovery again. And about four lines from the bottom, the best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. So that's a reason to do step five. Fairly decent one, I think. On page 73, first full paragraph, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much the actor. This is the actor thing. You remember we talked about on page 60? He wants to run the whole show. Now he wants to run what they think of him. But it's the same actor. Presents a stage character, the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. That's my story. Bottom of the page, we must be entire. We know we're skipping a lot of great stuff here. Our mission isn't to cover it all. It's not our mission. If we expect to live long or happily in this world, and we think well before we choose the person to whom we're going to give this fifth step, and I think we all know that there aren't any rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first one is mentioned here on page 74. At the bottom of the page, you see the word notwithstanding. Count up three lines above that. The rule is that we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. I can't do my fifth step with somebody that may harm. Can't do it. I've seen so many people go out to make amends, and they dump their fifth step on their mother or their wife. It's a horrible thing to do. Horrible thing to do. Be very careful. I heard a discussion about who should hear it. The men I sponsor are free to do their fist up with anybody they want to, and me. I'm going to be there. And if they need to do it with a priest and so on, I'm great with that. I don't have a problem with it. I plan to be there. This is an experience out of my past. My sponsor used to run a treatment facility, and I was doing some part-time stuff down there, and we had a guy come in on Monday morning just devastated. On Saturday, he had done his fifth step with his preacher. On Sunday morning, his preacher had delivered his fifth step to the congregation with him and his wife sitting there and his name tied to it. So do what you need to do. Yeah. And I saw the blood on that floor. And I don't know how that guy's doing now. I have no idea. But I'm telling you what. Anyhow. So I got to be careful about who I choose. And this thing about being considerate of others, Bob made a point when we were doing one of these a year or so ago. That's an awfully good way to approach step nine, too. And just for fun, while we're doing rules, I think there's one on maybe 101, 102, somewhere, 102 maybe?
Two, yeah.
Yeah. Is there? No, bottom of 101.
Yeah, 101.
Yeah. Paragraph near the bottom. So our rule, we don't have any rules. Here's the next one. Our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason to be there. It goes on to say that, and make sure my spiritual house is in order. And then the other rule that I found here is on page 118 in the chapter Two Wives. A guy I sponsor says it's only misprint in the book. T-O, Two Wives, should be T-W-O, Two Wives. That's the average. Page 118. Paragraph begins in the middle of the page with we women. Count up three lines above. Live and let live is the rule. Yeah, just for fun. Back on page 75, we talk about the fact that this is a life or death thing. And what I see is a one-sentence direction on how to do step five. It says we pocket our pride and go to it illuminating. That means to shine light into. Illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And I'd like to ask him, before we start, are you nervous? If a guy's doing his first fifth step, are you nervous? If he says no, we're wasting our time because he already knows what he's not going to tell me. And I shared that with a guy I sponsored, had about a year and a half, and he's going to hear his first fifth step. And he said to the guy, are you nervous? The guy said no. And Rick said to him, you already know what you're not going to tell me. He said the guy came apart, bawling, snot slinging, and told him the whole truth right there. They were done with that fifth step very quickly. Because it's that simple. If he's not nervous, he knows what he's not going to tell me. If he's nervous, he's either going to tell me or he's not sure. I'll take either one of those. I'll take either one. And we're going to sit down prayerfully. We got the phones turned off. We got some Kleenex. We got some drinks. We had restroom. We're by ourselves. And I'm going to ask him to pray for clarity of mind and courage to say what he needs to say. And I'm going to ask God to make me perfect. The book says I can do that on page 13. Last full paragraph, four lines from the bottom of that paragraph. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. And I ask him to make me perfect when I sit to hear a fifth step. I find no directions on how to hear a fifth step, and all I have is what my lineage passed to me. In my lineage, we don't hear fifth steps, we exchange them. And we do this prayer thing. And then I say to him, I want you now to tell me the single worst thing you ever did. I want it right now. And when he tells me, then I tell him when I did that. And the odds are good, I did. And then I want the next worst thing you ever did. And I tell him when I did that. And he may hit one that I didn't do. And we do that until he can't think of one. If he misses one of my big ones, I make sure he hears that from me. And then we reference his four-step and look around and see if he's missed anything. That's just how I do it. Fifth steps are running somewhere right around 2 hours these days. They can go for days and days and days if we do the free form thing and just, you know, tell me about it. It can take forever, especially a guy not sure he's going to tell it all. He can take forever getting to the big stuff. And I found if I get the big stuff out early, it happens pretty fast. I then like to read him. When he believes he's finished and I believe he's finished, I ask a series of questions. Have you harmed any human being or have you hurt an animal? I'm surprised how many of us have beaten dogs. There's a big number on that. Have you had a homosexual experience? Even if he's already given one, I ask if there's another. Have you had sex with an animal or a family member? And please don't read between these lines, okay? I'm going to talk about something here that's politically a fairly hot topic these days. I ask him if he's been involved in an abortion. There are a lot of people who are just fine with that, and that suits me fine. I don't have a comment on that. There's some of us that's the heaviest load we're carrying, and some of them have got it buried down so deep they can't even find it. And so I ask that question. And then I ask him if there's anything they had decided not to tell me or they were unsure whether they would tell me, either of those. And then if I think he's finished and he thinks he's finished, I read him the fifth step promises here on page 75, which is the balance of that paragraph, and tell him that he's finished the first half of step five. And then the book says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. I want you to go home. Now, if you don't have a home that you can go to that's safe, you can stay here. This will be your home for now. If you drive home, I don't want you to turn your cell phone on. I don't want you to turn on the radio. I don't even want you to listen to one of my CDs. I mean, this is commitment. This is commitment we're talking about here. All right? I want you to mentally hold the space. You go home. He says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better, because I also tell him at the end that I forgive him, that I believe God does, and that by the time we finish step 9, I believe he will have forgiven himself. It's been my experience. Taking the book down from the shelf. I'll expect you to go home, put your book on a shelf. It'll need to be shoulder level or higher. I'm going to want to know about that tomorrow. I will be asking. That's ridiculous, and I require it. That's what it says. And then, without reading the balance of this paragraph, what it says is you sit for an hour and talk to God about those first 5 steps. Have you been thorough? Call me. Somewhere approaching 50% of the time, I get a phone call within the next 24 hours that he just did flat forget something. Just forgot it. Great, no problem. We take that one on the phone. Don't worry about it. I see it's not quite half, but it's pretty close. See a lot of that. Tapas 76 says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, that's what we've been through with the first 5 after 1 hour. We then look at step 6. Oh, steps 5 and 6 are apparently done the same day. We emphasize willingness. Are we now ready for God to remove all the things we've admitted are objectionable? Can he take them all, every one? And then here's a very cleverly concealed 6-step prayer. If we cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And then it says, when ready, oh my goodness, looks like 7's done that same day too. We say something like this, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And here's the amen we talked about before. Kind of interesting. I swear this wasn't here. I thought that I was asking God to remove all my defects of character. It's not what it says. It's just the ones that stand away in my usefulness. It had never occurred to me that I wouldn't ask him to take them all. And it hadn't occurred to me that God could possibly use one or more of my character defects as tools to help me. And I had that experience a couple of years ago. What we do here is a little bit on the dangerous side. I mean, it's okay if you think one of us is great. It's not okay if we do. And I get to thinking I was. I had too many people telling me I was great and I changed lives, and I started believing it myself. Okay if you put me on a pedestal, not okay if I do. And I got up on the pedestal, and I came pretty close to doing something that would have been pretty bad. And I came down off that pedestal. And God used that character defect as a tool to help me. It's a powerful God. It's an amazing process. My sponsor said that the book doesn't say anything at all about me working on my character defects. And when I work on the character defects, I am living in the problem. And that all of my character defects are self-centered. There are no exceptions to that. And self can't push self out of the center. If it could, it would leave a vacuum. So the answer to my character defects is not for me to work on them. The answer to my character defects is for me to do the things that you've taught me to do to lead a God-centered life. And when I do that, my character defects just recede. It's not like I take power over them. They just recede. What I do is invite the light in and the darkness flees, because the darkness cannot exist in the light. So I don't focus on the darkness. I get involved with the light. And that's how I get changed. That's what happens to me. Somebody asked me a while back, do I think the path gets narrower? And I think the best answer I ever heard was, if I stay on the center line, I won't notice.
Thanks, Scott. There's an old adage in Alcoholics Anonymous that if 3 frogs were sitting on a log and one of them made a decision to jump in the water, how many frogs are still on the log? And some new guy will say, well, 2. And the old timer will go, no, he only made a decision. He's still on the log. If you were to carry out the decision, it would be in step 7 that you'd hear the splash. This is really where we set down all our defense mechanisms and become entirely ready. And this is a very small little step and a very small little paragraph on the top of page 76. And yet, I think it encompasses the story of a lot of our sobriety, how we become entirely ready. My sponsor tells a story. He uses an analogy that I think is pretty good. He said that we're so beaten by the bag and the bottle that we come to AA and we're forced to throw the towel in. And then what happens is the ego sneaks back in there when nobody's looking. We kind of get the towel back, and we'll spend the rest of our lives ripping off little pieces of it and throwing it back in. As we get to that place where God is either everything or he's nothing about the IRS. He's everything or he's nothing about the police. He's everything or nothing about the relationship, the children, the job, the judgments in AA, the lust, the gambling, the food, or whatever the deal is. We keep throwing in the pieces of the towel. How do we become entirely ready? Well, Scott talked about not working on your character defects, and I went through a period of about 5 or 6, I don't know, quite a few years of my sobriety where I did an honest look at me. I could see these things were objectionable. I could see where they cut me off from the sunlight of the spirit, that kept me entrenched in self and all that stuff. But I thought it's my job to not be that way anymore. And what I discovered is, if in defects of character, if you try to willfully overcome them, what happens is you become the reformed whatever. You know, like a reformed smoker who is so intolerant of other people who smoke, who's up on the high horse all the time, you know, that guy. You become the reformed whatever. And so I spent, I had this tremendous bottom with judgment in AA. I mean, I was, you know, sitting in meetings taking people's inventory. And so I decided, I'm not coming to, I didn't go to God with it. I said, I'm just not going to be that way ever again. And what I became is I wasn't doing that anymore, but I became very judgmental of people who are judgmental. Right? Which makes me exactly like them. Right? It's like whatever in the universe, for every reaction there's an opposite and equal reaction. Whatever I try to overcome with self-will seems to give it power. Confucius once said that the chains that bind us most closely are the ones we have broken. If I'm fighting something, if I'm a reformed something, I am still as hostage to that as the when I was doing it. We're not talking about we're talking about something greater than that. We're talking about a new freedom. We're not talking about fighting something. Remember what happens to us with alcohol. Later in the 10th step, it says we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. And I think that is absolutely the case with defects of character. Because there's a later on in the book, it talks about fighting stuff with self-will, and it says it is our experience, it's referring to drinking, that if we do that, we always will break out in a bigger explosion than ever, right? I sponsored a guy. I started sponsoring him back in about 1980 or 81, I guess. And good guy. And he... We did some step work, and he had a couple defects of character that he really had a hard time with, and they were defects that had caused him a lot of problems. It threatened him to go to prison for a long time. Involved some behaviors that are not looked on very well in this society, and you can go to jail for a long time, and you have a hard time in jail. It's really kind of a bad deal. And yet he was obsessed with some of this stuff. So he made up his mind he would just never be, he's never going to do that. And for as far as I know, for 14 years of his sobriety, he fought that with self-will. And it was some sexual behavior. And what happened is he became the most judgmental person about other people's sexual conduct I've ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unbelievable. He was judgmental of heterosexuals, homo. He was every sexual behavior, every date, people dating. He always had something snide and condescending to say about it because he was the reformed guy, right? And the reason he couldn't, and I told him one time, you got to take, you know, this is do step six. He never could do step 6 and 7 with it because he believed that it was such a he had such a strong judgment on it that he believed he had to overcome this in order for God to be, for him and God to be okay. So for 14 years, he didn't act out on the behavior. And then 14 years through the internet, he hooked up with some people that were into that kind of stuff, and he got back into it. And what happened is he couldn't tell me about it, and he couldn't take it to God because he was ashamed of himself. And he would act out on some of this behavior, and he would sink into a deep depression, like an emotional hangover as a result of it. And a doctor in Alcoholics Anonymous who was not a psychiatrist, who didn't even interview him, just was at a meeting, and the guy was depressed, and he said, here, take these, and gave him pills for the depression that allowed him to continue the behavior. Well, about a year later, then now the antidepressants aren't enough anymore, and now he can't sleep, and now he calls me up one day, and he says, I need to talk to you. And I said, yeah, I haven't talked to you in a while. He hadn't been calling me. I said, what's going on? He says, well, my doctor wants me to take sleeping pills, and I think I need to take them. I said, Rob, I said, you can't take sleeping pills. He says, no, it's not like you think. I said, listen, if you can't sleep, there's a reason, we need to find out. He says, no, it's not like that. He says, it's an adverse reaction to the antidepressants. And I said, I'm supposed to be a sponsor. I said, you're on antidepressants. He said, yeah. I said, how long have you been on those? He says, oh, about a year. I said, how come you didn't tell me? Oh, it didn't mean anything. I just didn't think you needed to know. Oh, okay. Well, I said to him, I said, look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know about antidepressants. I don't know. That's something a psychiatrist should decide. But I know one thing. Alcoholics, I don't believe, should take sleeping pills. If you can't sleep, there's a reason you can't sleep. And let's find out what that is. And he said, oh, no, it's not that at all. I need this. It's a chemical reaction to the other medication, et cetera. And he started taking them. Well, a little bit later, he had a heart incident, and he had to have some surgery. And when they put him on pain pills as a matter of standard procedure for that kind of surgery, it just took off within no time at all. His brother comes and gets me, and he says, Rob's in trouble. And we go to the hospital, and he's in intensive care. He's strapped down. He was doing over 30 Lortabs a day from all different doctors, and now they checked that stuff, and now they all found out at the same time. They all cut him off on the same day. So he went an instant withdrawal. He's in danger of cardiac arrest or stroking out because his blood pressure's off the charts, and they have been strapped down in intensive care, and he's kicking all these narcotics, and plus Ativan and some other benzos and some stuff, and he was in bad shape. I walk into the room where he's strapped down, and the first thing he says when he sees me, he starts crying. He goes, "This doesn't mean I have to change my sobriety date, does it?" The amazing power of the ego, isn't that? Now here's a guy who's dying, and he's caring about how he looks, right? I mean, that's kind of bizarre, really. And I just said, "Look, let's just get you straightened out. We'll talk about that later." Well, he refused to change his sobriety date. I was at his 16th AA birthday. He was so stoned on pills, he was slurring his words. He was going, "Now I'm going to talk. What am I here for? My sponsor, right?" And I didn't know what to say. He called on me in the meeting. I did the kindest, honest thing I could do. I just said, "I'd like to congratulate Rob on 16 years of not drinking alcohol." And that was true, and it was kind, and it was honest. And he eventually, within 2 months after that, he drank again. You know, that thing inside us, there's a spiritual mechanism where we're compelled to make our insides match our outsides. You know, the need for continuity within us is a powerful thing. And within a year after that, he was dead. And he was dead because he could not bring something to the table in step 6, right? All he had to do was ask God, but he couldn't do it. And I understand that. I had a lot of things I couldn't bring to God. I was afraid. Eventually, over the years, what happens is you get worn out with some of this stuff. And I discovered that a lot of my defects of character, I would have to get – it'd be like very much like drinking. It's – I have to get to a place with the defect that I got to in drinking. Now, what did it happen to me with drinking? Is I got to a place where I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I can drink till it kills me. There's no more value in drinking. There's no more fun in it. As long as I secretly thought there was a party there, I'm not really ready for AA yet. Not really. I could intellectually think, well, you know, you really should stop drinking. This is really hurting you. But as long as I think there's a party in there somewhere, I ain't ready. And as long as I secretly thought there was value in these defective defense mechanisms, I ain't ready. It don't make me a bad guy. It just makes me the way I am. And what are the values? Here's what happened to me. I started praying about some of this stuff. I'd start asking God to remove it. But I'm a hypocrite. I don't really want God to remove the defect. I want him to remove the consequences. In Bill's story, there's a thumbnail sketch of him going through the steps with Ebby in the hospital. And in that thumbnail sketch, he says something different. He says when he's talking about step 6 and 7, he says he asked his creator to remove these things, root and branch, as if there's two parts. And I know about the branch, that's the consequences. That's the thing that's poking me in the eye. But what's the root? What's the secret hidden idea of value or something or gratification from the defect? I mean, I know everybody would like the branch of resentment to be removed. I mean, nobody likes that you can't sleep and your head's going like a rotisserie all night and there's no peace. Nobody likes walking into a room and that person's there and you just and seizes up. Or the person you resent, somebody tells you, hey, did you know they just bought a nice new car? And you go, ah, right? Now, I'd like to be free from that, but am I willing to give up the pleasure of judgment? You can't be free of one without the other. It's like saying to God, take away the hangovers, but let me drink. It's a package of cause and effect. And Chamberlain used to say that this was a process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. I have to get the truth. I have to awaken to the realization that there is this thing that I think is defending me against a life that is threatening, a life that is vacant, a life that is desolate, a life that is lonely, isn't really working. That all the things I'm using to protect me are actually exasperating the things I'm trying to protect myself against. And they make it worse because they're defective. And that's the problem, is I'm afraid to let go of the known for something that is unknown. Paul, an old friend of mine, Paul, who's actually stories in the book, who died a few years ago, Paul said there's a sense of security in the familiar, no matter how painful it may be. There's an old TV show I saw when I was a little kid. It was called Rescue 8. And it was a wonderful episode. And it's funny how you remember stuff. But I remember this episode. And these two paramedics, their job was to go out and help people that were in trouble. And this one episode, they come out on this call. And there's this little girl, cute little girl. And she's stuck with her arm wedged into a vending machine. And she's crying and she's upset and her parents are there and they're upset. And now the firemen are showing up and they're pulling saws and torches off the truck and they're going to cut this door off. And all this equipment is scaring the girl. It's scaring the parents. It's making it worse. And she's crying and she's in a lot of pain and please get me out of here. And the one fireman's just standing back watching all this. One paramedic, and he looks at her and he says, sweetheart, do you got something in your hand? And she went, uh-huh. What do you got in your hand? A candy bar. Well, sweetheart, can you let go of the candy bar? It's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. But we can't get you out unless you let... It's my candy bar. But sweetheart, we can't get you out unless you let go of the candy. It's my candy bar. And then he says to her, he says, sweetheart, if you will let go of that candy bar, I promise you, I will get you two candy bars. And because she finally trusted him, she said, really? And he said, I promise you. And she let go of the candy bar and her hand slid right out of the vending machine. And I think sometimes with God and our defects of character, it's like that. Do I trust God enough to let down and give up these defenses? And that's really what they are. If you look at surrenders in movies, what happens? The person surrendering lays down all their ability to defend themselves. They discard their knives, their hand grenades, their rifles, their pistols. They make themselves utterly defenseless, and they sit on the side of the road and they wait for someone to come along and tell them what to do. And what's our experience is we surrender, and everything we're trying to protect ourselves and get, we get. And we're safe and protected. We never had to protect ourselves to begin with. I'll tell you a little quick story about the Japanese. And do we have time?
Yeah, we'll make time.
All right.
I love this story.
In the mid-1940s, the Japanese Empire was faced with extinction. Two atomic weapons had been set off in two of their large industrial centers, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They had no atomic weapons. They had no defense against that. They were terrorized. I mean, they really were looking at extinction. They were looking at their ultimate destruction. And they were forced into a surrender very similar to some of us when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, an absolute lack of alternatives. And they met with the Pacific Fleet. Scott has a little story tells sometimes about that. But the bottom line is that they signed the formal terms of surrender, which in essence was their third step, which is our formal terms of surrender. But that was not the end. An inventory must be taken of all their defenses, their army, their cannons, their ships, their planes, and then they must be dismantled and rendered over to us to leave them virtually defenseless. And at that point, I can't imagine. I'll tell you, I can't imagine a more fear-wrought surrender, because they had to do that in the face of knowing that we knew what they did at Pearl Harbor, knowing about the Bataan Death March and the camps and the torture and all that stuff. They had to surrender and make themselves absolutely vulnerable to a person, to an entity that they had hurt extremely. I can't imagine a more fear-wrought surrender. Within no time at all after that surrender, they were forced into an ethic that all surrendered entities are forced into. We are an ethic of service, an ethic of moving yourself aside to serve a greater whole. And if you ever studied or looked at Japanese businesses back after, in the decades that followed World War II, they developed a tremendous ethic, and they started just rocking and rolling, because the individual was no longer important. The whole was greater than the individual. And they had removed self out of the equation to serve a higher goal, a higher purpose. And within 4 decades of a surrender, of living a surrender and a life of service, the Japanese owned more of the United States than they could have ever conquered or held by military means. I was over in Maui, was visiting some friends I was over in Maui at the height of their. Oh man, we're not even talking about billionaires in Japan, just regular guys, their standard of living was so high. They would come to Hawaii and just say, I'll buy those 4 houses there. The real estate market in Hawaii just went sky high, because they had such income. They had such spendable income. They had the highest standard of living in the world, and not just the highest by a little bit. I mean, it was really up there. And then I was over in Japan for an AA convention in 1990, and I watched the beginning of their demise. I watched the new generation who didn't care for this selflessness and this honor. And they were the me first generation. They were the generation that wanted to wear American clothes. They were the generation that wanted to listen to American rock and roll. They were the generation that didn't respect the old ways. They were the self-centered, narcissistic generation. I'm a food guy. I love gourmet foods. Japan at that time and still to this day has some of the greatest chefs in the world. If you ever read, the original Iron Chef was all Japanese chefs. Unbelievable. Food is an art form. And I went to some of the greatest restaurants I've ever been to in Japan. There was one restaurant in Tokyo that you couldn't get into. There was a line two blocks long in 1990. McDonald's. I saw that and I thought, oh, I'll put a fork in them. They're done. And what happened to them is the same thing that happens to us. Self starts inundating it back. How many times we see newcomers, I'll surrender, I just want to help people. Yes, I'll make the amends, anything. And then 3 years later, the ego's back and they're just, all they care about is themselves. When the entity fills up with self, the spirit starts to die. There's only so much room. It's either self or spirit. And the more you bring in one, that pushes out the other.
Our great teacher told me one time that the alcoholic is like an electromagnet that's been dragged through the junkyard of life. We got all this rusty, sharp, nasty, jagged, ugly stuff stuck all over us. And what we do with these steps is we very slowly turn the power down and eventually off, and this stuff begins to fall away, and this beautiful thing I've always really been emerges from the inside of that. We're not going to change me into something. We're going to teach me to quit having all of those things that I no longer need. And God was not having a bad day in the middle of a long losing streak when he came up with me or any of you. We were wrong. It didn't happen that way. And as I learn to lay down all of those defenses, this beautiful thing that we've always been emerges. We are going to start again at 33 minutes after the hour.